All right, Dan, I think that's enough of me running my mouth, man. Let's get the people what they want. Who are you? What do you do? And we'll go from there.
The easy questions, huh? The existential ones on a on a Tuesday morning. I like
we'll get to those here in a second.
All right, all right. I'm Dan. I'm a husband. I'm a dad. I'm a designer and a creative director. I've run my own agency. I've worked at a bunch of agencies. I am a consultant and I'm a teacher. I teach people how to do this tech thing because it feels like a cheat code. It feels like just because we could push some pixels around, people will fly around the world and pay a lot of money and respect you and, you know, all these things. And I think I want that for more people in the world.
Absolutely. I love that so much. And y'all, the comments have been great. We got people all around. We got India. We got Spain. We got Chicago. That's, you know, it's great. I love it. I love it. All right, Dan. So there's a lot to cover today and you had a lot of great ideas. Again, I don't have upset questions. I literally get the guest on 15 minutes before we go live and I go, what do you want to talk about? And so here we are. So the first thing I want to dive into, and I think it's super important right now, is the layoffs, right? I want to get this out of the way. I want to talk about it. Snapchat laid off people yesterday. I mean, the layoffs keep coming. Man, what are your just general thoughts on the market? Maybe some words of encouragement to some people, and we'll just go from there.
I'm going to start with words of discouragement right now, but let's get to the encouragement.
There you go.
But
it sucks. Bad news first, then good news. I like it. That's like what you're doing.
It sucks right now. Like it, and it's. I've been doing this for 25 years. It is the worst that I've seen right now, because it's hard. Because all of a sudden companies are laying people off by the tens of thousands. Like that is bananas. And there's a ton of people that I see that are looking for jobs. And there are a ton of people that I see that are hiring for jobs. And you would think that one fills the other, right? It's like if a bunch of people are hiring and a bunch of people are looking for jobs, don't those two things go together? And yet we still hear stories of people who can't get jobs. And we still hear stories of companies who just can't hire fast enough. So something is happening. This is a moment, you know, right now.
Yeah.
Something is happening. And unfortunately, sometimes the thing that you do is you just let those waves go. You know, you just ride it for a while and it sucks. Yeah. So there are things that people can do, but I think one of those things that's really hard is just be patient.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, I mean, I left a job I was at for 12 years last year, right? I mean, it's caused a lot of people to either change careers, change jobs. It's wild. So Dan, what would be your advice for folks, man, right now? Like maybe just some tips and tricks, whether it's, you know, preparing themselves for a layoff, if they're in a, you know, if they're looking for a job, what they should do. So let's start first. Let's say someone works for a company right now and they're nervous about being laid off. There's some whispers and stuff. What should folks do right now?
Build as much leverage as you can. Mm-hmm. And that can come in a bunch of different forms. So one way to build leverage is just to stockpile cash, right? Because that gives you some leverage. It's like, I'm not worried if I've got 6 months of emergency fund in the bank. I'm not worried as much about getting laid off because I've got some runway. So that's one way that you can build some leverage is build, you know, stockpile some cash if you can, you know, like cut down your expenses, stockpile some cash. Another way that you can do it is you can build your skills up, right? You can learn new skills. AI is a thing that not a lot of people know how to do well right now. Hop on that train, learn a new skill, get ahead of a curve, you know, whatever that is. It doesn't have to be AI. It could be, you know, the newest JavaScript library that you're like, this thing is going to be a big thing. I'm going to go learn that thing before everybody else does, make a name for myself, tweet about it, LinkedIn post about it. Like that's another way to build leverage is to make yourself a whatever the opposite of a commodity is. Right. So don't be a commodity. Don't do something that everybody else can do, because then you're just part of a pool of 10,000 people who are trying to do the same thing that you are.
Yep.
Be part of a pool of one. If you're the only person who can do a thing or the only person who can do a thing that way, you become in demand in that way. So however you can build leverage for yourself, whether that's cash or skills or networking or knowing people that other people don't know or knowing a trade that other people don't know, those are good ways of kind of building yourself some security with whatever is coming next.
Yep, 100%. Talk to me about, I mean, so first off, there's not many people talking about, you're the first guest I've had, we're talking about layoffs that like I've said, save money. Like, listen, we've had to cut back, right? I mean, literally like my entire profession is built on the software industry and it hasn't been great for 2 years. So again, I mean, you know, we've had to make cuts in the Destin household, and that's a conversation my wife and I are constantly having, but no one's talking about it. So Dan, I'm glad you brought that up.
Same thing in the mall household too. It's, you know, it's like, Like, we've been in a position where me running my own agency and my own company, we've made millions and millions of dollars. And we've also been in a point where it's like time to dip into savings, you know, and we're lucky that we've had savings. And to watch those savings deplete and deplete and deplete as the industry is going through whatever it's going through sucks, you know, and it's terrifying and it's scary. But what's even scarier is like, man, what if we didn't have that? You know, what other things would we have to do? You know, would we have to move in with our parents? You know, again, would we have to you know, get roommates in our house? Like all those kinds of things become possibilities. And we're lucky to not have to do that because we had some savings that we could rely on.
Yeah. Dan, I'm coming to live with you. I'm just kidding. So let's talk about, so somebody does get laid off, man. I mean, obviously, you know, I was even thinking about last night, like putting myself, cause I saw people on Twitter yesterday getting laid off, and I'm trying to put myself in the shoes I was in when I left my job at 12 years in June of last year. And I just was like it gave me anxiety even looking back on myself that where I was in June. So again, what people are going through right now is legit. It's heavy. What are some like good things, like practical things that you would recommend when they get the layoff?
So I have practical things that are not popular things, right? I think what
want. I love non-popular practical things. Yeah, so, I love that. I love it. Bring it, Dan.
One of the quotes that's been giving me life the last year or two is, I'm going to make sure I get it right. No one can, if you chase two rabbits, you will catch neither. So it's an ancient proverb. If you chase two rabbits, you will catch neither. So what a lot of people want is they want a well-paying job doing something that they love. And it's like, hey, if you can find that, awesome. That's
the bar graph, top and to the right? One of those things? Yeah.
Totally. You're like, of course I want that. Where it gets really tricky is like, what if you could only pick one? Which one would you pick? And a lot of people don't have an answer to that. And they get caught unaware when they get laid off and they go, oh, now I have to pick. And now I have to pick from a place of desperation. So now what do I do? So for me, like something that ever since I was a junior designer, I always had in the back of my mind, if I got to go manage a Burger King, I'm cool with that. If I've got to go drive for UPS, I'm cool with that.
I'm so glad you brought this up.
Because what is important to me is providing for my family. Correct. Design does that for me right now really well. So I want to stick with that as long as I can. But the minute it doesn't, I'm going to go do something else that's an easy decision for me because I've already made it. And now I can just follow past Dan's instructions, you know, past Dan's good decisions. I can just honor those decisions now. Whereas if I have to make that decision under duress, that's really, really difficult to do.
Glad you brought this up because there's a lot of people out there that really stick to their guns. And listen, I mean, like the doctor patient confidentiality that I have, I've talked to so many people that are like, tweeting and posting and whatnot is it's almost comical of how much I know behind the scenes. And there are a lot of people who aren't willing to compromise. And it's like, listen, you got compromise. We're not in the roaring 2 years ago that we were in. We are in a time where you have to grind and take a job and may not get, because again, I mean, full transparency, I'm all about being trained. I took a 40% pay cut. Now, a lot of that's because of the market. Again, I'm more heavily commissioned on placing engineers and jobs. But at the end of the day, I took 40%. I've been 40% of a cut, right? And so, man, you just got to be aware. Like, you just
totally
awareness is huge right now.
Totally. Yep. And for me, like, I haven't had to take pay cuts because it's always been my own company. But I shut down my agency 2 years ago. And what I was making then, I'm making 50% of that now, right? Which is like, if you're not prepared for that, that's tough to deal with. You know, all of a sudden you got to cut your expenses by half when you're not prepared to deal with that. Like that's when you get into the, like, should we sell our house territory? And those are very difficult conversations to have when you have to have them in the moment and when you have to have them fast. So the more you can think about that stuff in advance, you know, the better off you're going to be. And that's another example of building leverage is like preparedness is a form of leverage. You know, 100%. If you've got money in the bank, if you've got whatever, canned food in your garage, whatever that is, like all of those are versions of being prepared.
Yep, absolutely. Committing to tech is great, but not working because you have illusions that tech is all the work you can do is hurting a lot of people. Yeah, 100%, 100%. I want to kind of get into the next thing again. Dan, you and I could probably chat about this specific topic for the rest of the 20 minutes we have together, but I want to kind of move on to a very similar topic that could really help a lot of people right now is the idea and thought of freelancing and contracting versus perm. Also, Dan, by the way, since we have been talking, I just saw a tweet that DocuSign just laid off 6% of people an hour ago.
Oh, geez.
So there you go. So talk about, I think when everything's good, I think people want perm. And then when things are bad, like it is now, people scrounge and scrap and are open to contract freelancing. But I think right now, as somebody who's placed a lot of contractors, I work at a talent marketplace. We do a lot of freelance work, right? I think you can really make a good career out of it, but I think people are scared to go out on their own. So Dan, you've been out on your own, man. Do you got some like Dan's five tips to succeed? I don't know, something like that.
I don't know about five tips. I'll try to hit five. I don't know. One of the things that I learned in running my own agency, and I started as a freelancer. So I was always freelancing on the side while working for somebody else until one day, you know, I think 12 years later, I was like, all right, I'm going to start my own agency. And one of the things I learned running my own agency or freelancing full time or, you know, whatever you want to call it, is that I thought, well, at some point you just get good enough that the leads keep coming in. The whole feast or famine thing, like that's the scary thing about freelancing. It's like, oh, it's feast or famine. So you take what you can get and, you know, in the good times, and then that way you can just ride out the bad times. I thought that like if I only got good enough, whatever that threshold was, you figure out the feast or famine thing. And that has never happened for me. Maybe I just never got good enough. I don't know. But it's like, but that never happened. What I learned instead was a different lesson. And the lesson that I learned there was like, you just learn to be okay with that. Like you accept the fact that like, you know, June and July for me, for my business, June and July were always slow. So what do? You plan for June and July to be slow. You don't go, well, if only I was better, June and July wouldn't be slow. No, right. June and July is when I take my family on vacation, right? So I work hard in January when all the leads are coming in. Clockwork on September 25th, that's when leads started pouring in because a lot of our clients were corporate, you know, we're corporate clients, enterprises. And so that's when the buying cycle begins. So learning when your client's buying cycle begins and going like, that's when they spend money. That's when they stop spending money. This is when you're not going to hear from anybody. Like over a couple of years, I was able to identify that and go, you know what? We started to create policies around that at my agency. In December, we do not start new projects, period. We don't. Yeah. You know, and it was like every December, it's like, oh, but this one might be an exception. Nope, we have a policy around this. And so like you start to learn those cycles and then you start to be comfortable with those cycles. I'm chilling because, you know, if June and July is slow, that's fine. That's when we're going to go on vacation. And thank you for it being slow because otherwise I wouldn't be able to go on vacation with my family.
Yeah.
But knowing that was the thing that, and accepting that was the thing that really helped.
100%. I do want to get to this LinkedIn user because I hear this all the time. The lack of health insurance scares me about contract work. Dan, I have thoughts on this. I want to hear your thoughts first because obviously you're the guest. I'm not.
I do have simple thoughts on this. The simple thoughts are, how much does health insurance cost? And for different people, it's very astronomically different. For sure. Some people, yeah, it's like, I can get a really good plan for $600 a month. For other people, it's like, I have very specific medical conditions and I need to pay about $6,000 a month out of pocket. So the question becomes, can you make an extra $6,000 a month working on your own or not? If the answer is no, consider not doing that, or consider not doing it until you have an emergency fund that can cover your health insurance for a year or two, yeah, or whatever, to give you that advantage. So that's my simple thing about health insurance. It's a money problem. That's, yes, what it is, at least in the US. It's a, yeah, money problem. So if you can make that amount of money, spend the money. It sucks because when you're a full-time employee, you don't see it come out of your check. So it's invisible. When you're a freelancer or when you're consulting or a contractor or you run your own business, it becomes visible. So it hurts a little bit more, but there are ways that you can automate it so that it feels invisible again. So it becomes a question of money. I think it's worth doing the math on that. So to me, the math gives me comfort to go, oh, you know, to pay for my family is $2,200 a month, you know, like to have decent health insurance. That's a lot of money, but can I make $2,200 more a month on my own? I think I can. Here's how I think I can do that. Here's my plan to do that.
Yeah.
And that gave me a lot of comfort.
Yeah. LinkedIn user, I want to get to this too. Again, I am not insurance expert. And actually even interviewing you, Dan, I'm like, I should go out and just bring an insurance person on to talk more about this. But
yes,
for me, like, so I was at a perm job for 12 years and the benefits were fine. It wasn't great, but I went to a startup and the benefits weren't that great. And I didn't know how long I was going to be without work. So I immediately signed up with Farm Bureau. So Farm Bureau, I don't know if it's just a Nashville or like a Tennessee thing or what. I know Farm Bureau is all over the place, but like, the benefits that my family has now, it is annoying because there's some pre-existing conditions that we have to like bring, that's been annoying. So like they've charged us and they shouldn't have, that's been a nightmare. But as a whole though, we're getting that figured out. But as a whole, the benefits we have now are better than what I had and cheaper by like half. And all it took was me talking to my financial advisor. He's got a big family. He said, you need to look this up. We've had our three kids on this insurance plan, and it's great. So again, I'm not an insurance benefit person by any means, but do a little research and ask around, right? Like ask me, ask Dan, ask freelancers that you know on tech Twitter or whatever, like, hey, how do you do benefits? We'll all tell you. I'll tell again, Farm Bureau. I do the family. It's like $625 a month.
Yep. There are a ton of private insurance brokers that know the private insurance industry, the public insurance industry. They know how to help you sign up for the Affordable Care Act or the open enrollments, and like all of that kind of stuff. Again, I'm not an expert, but I had to learn about it in order, you know, because I'm like, oh, I don't know anything about this. And now all of a sudden it's my responsibility running my own company.
Yep.
So, you know, there are people out there. You're just not aware of them because they never crossed your path until you're in that situation. So before you're in that situation, if you can, start doing the research, you know, find out who else is out there. Who in my city does this? You know, who in my city has private coverage? What does that look like? How much does it cost? And, you know, like Taylor's saying, like, we feel like it's a cheat code to have this information and we like sharing it. So people who have figured this out love sharing it too. They just don't know that you care about it. So you got to ask, you know, but once you ask, you know, for me, at least the floodgates opened, you know, tweet something, LinkedIn post something, Instagram post something, and just be like, I need help with insurance, and people will come flocking
Dude,
to you.
Dude, I'm telling you, people come flying, leveraging social. We can get, there's so much to break down, and we're getting a ton of great. If you have questions, please ask. I want to get some questions real quick. Sharada comes in. Thanks for sharing your experiences, Dan. How do you approach your clients in the initial phase of your freelancing? Getting the first project is really hard.
Yep. Okay, so a couple of practical tips on this. When I started freelancing, the first thing that I should say is freelance with leverage as much as you can. If you have a lot of cash in the bank, you're not as scared if a client says no, if you charge them a high rate. Once you charge a client a high rate, because you're not worried about them saying no and you're projecting that confidence, a lot of times they'll say yes, and that'll give you the confidence to keep charging that rate. What sucks is if you're like, I have no money this month. I got to put food on the table. I got to close this client. You'll do that job for peanuts. And while it helps because it does put food on the table temporarily, it doesn't help you in the long run because now you believe that that is what you're worth, that is what your work is worth, whereas that was just the moment that you were in. And it's hard to get out of that moment once you reinforce it. So as much as you can, try to get your first client with leverage. If you're at a full-time job, that's when you start looking for clients because then you can write whatever contract you want because you're not worried about it because you have a full-time salary. If you're just going out on your own with no clients, that's a really tough place to be. Before you go out on your own, you know, the common wisdom is like line up a couple clients. But let's say for some of you are like, too late though, I'm on my own now. So what do I do? There's a couple things that you can do. One is for me, when I first started, I made a list of 300 people that I know would trust me to do a good job. People that I've worked with before, people who I was an intern with when they were the creative director at the time. And I wrote emails to all of those 300 people, personal emails, not a form letter, not, you know, copy and paste name, personal emails, like take the time to do it. And I asked for their scraps. Like, is there anything that you're too busy for? Is under your pay grade, you know, anything like that? I'll take anything you've got, any overflow work, any pass through work. Like I'll take any of that stuff. You need a website built. You need some code written. You need some design, you need some print work, you need some video production, like things that I didn't know how to do. I was like, I'll take all of that. Cause what I was trying to do was I was trying to build leverage. And I was trying to just go like, if I can just stockpile cash, then I can be choosier on the next couple of projects. So that's one thing. And then the second thing I'll share is if you can't do that, or for whatever reason, that's not working for you. What you can do is do the first project for a testimonial, not for free. Right. We can talk about whether or not you should work for free. I've got some opinions about that. Do it for a testimonial. That's the price. Dude, do this work for you. Yeah. Yeah.
The most, Dan, I got to get you on part two, man. We have so much to talk about. Testimonials is so underrated, folks. Like literally, if you want to go into freelancing career or any sort of contracting career, it's testimonials. Like it's huge, huge. Anyways, keep going, Dan. Sorry.
I mean, I think testimonials, what I've learned is that they are the number one objection breaker for the next client, because the next client is always worried about whether you can do a good job, especially if you don't have a big portfolio yet of doing that thing. Yep. Testimonials are the things that break through that. So So make sure that that first gig you get, okay, I'll do this for no money. I need it to take 6 weeks and no more than that. And I want you to write a testimonial for me. Even better, the power move is I'm going to write a testimonial in advance that I want you to pre-approve if I do this work. I won't post it anywhere, you know, until you approve it. But this is a testimonial that I want from you. I wrote it. Here it is. All you got to do is sign off on it. Like you're doing all the work for that client. That is what will parlay you into the next project, because now that free project that you did for that amazing testimonial, the next client is going to see that testimonial and be like, I'd pay $1,000 for that. I'd pay 10 grand for that. You know, whatever that project is, because that testimonial, what doesn't come with that testimonial is how much that client paid you. No one needs to know that part.
Yeah.
So if a testimonial is shining, somebody might go like, wow, you know, like, yeah, I'd pay $10,000 for a result like that. And that's the thing that kind of parlays you into the next project after that.
I love that. Robert comes in here. Dan, when you first started, how did you get your first client?
It was all overflow stuff. It was all like,
really?
I was not choosy. I think that was the thing, is like, I tried to earn the ability to be choosy. So when I first started, you needed a PowerPoint done, you know, neighbor. Let's do it. You know, like my neighbor who owns a landscaping company or whatever, I'll design that PowerPoint deck for you. That was one of my first jobs. You know, a local solar electric company whose friend played in a band with my friend. You need a one pager designed for you? Let's go. I'm down. You know, like though I think everybody, a lot of people think that like if you do a project, it's got to show up in your portfolio. No, if you do a project, it's got to show up in your bank account first. Then you can decide whether or not it shows up in your portfolio. So for me, I was like, all of these need to go in my bank account first, and then I'll decide what of it or which of them go in my portfolio later on. I really need to feed my bank account before I feed my portfolio.
I love that. Dominic comes in here. Hey, Dan, do you have any advice for building momentum with contracts or freelancing starting from zero? Is it the same system of networking you do for perm work, or are there idiosyncrasies to this space?
There are idiosyncrasies to every space, right? Different industries or different kinds of clients, like enterprise work is very different than startup work, you know, all that stuff. I will say there are some commonalities between all those things. So as an example, I think all of freelancing is based on relationships. You know, I think all of freelancing, all of doing work for people, is people want to hire people that they trust to do good work for them, right? They want you to do a good job for them. They're not gunning to, they don't want you to do a bad job so they can say, see, we hired someone terrible and now we're going to sue you. No one wants that outcome. You don't want it, that your potential client doesn't want it. And so in terms of building momentum and you know, build and contracts and all that kind of stuff, to me, that's what it's about. It's about finding someone who aligns with you, who wants work done the way that you do it, and then you doing the best job that you can for them. So, you know, to me, it's like, where can you find those people? And usually it's friends of friends. Mm-hmm. That's the place that I would start. I wouldn't, and this is mostly because I haven't had good success with this. So that's not to say that you can't have good success, but I wouldn't start cold calling, or I wouldn't start like putting flyers on cars at your local supermarket or anything like that. You know, that's a hard game to play. That's a numbers game of just pounding the pavement. So I wouldn't do that. I would call friends of friends. I would call friends first and just say, hey, do you have a friend that would need this video production service that I do, or this motion graphic thing that I do, or this social media product that I have? You know, do you know somebody who needs that? And you want that trust to transfer. That's hard to do when you put a flyer on somebody's windshield.
I love that. Let's see here. So many questions, y'all. Thank you so much. Garrett comes in here. If you're unemployed, you may qualify for state supported programs that are bleeding to death paying for COBRA, 100%. Let's see here. Shane comes in here. I'm a design systems lead at an agency. I can show the design work on my portfolio, but not the projects that adopted the components because of the NDA. Any tip? Shane, great question, man.
Great question. I know a lot of people, especially in the design system space, design system work is different than design work, because a lot of it is not about the tangible artifacts that you can show. Even if you could show those things, even if they weren't under NDA, it's actually not the story of the project anyway. So, you know, there's a couple things that you can do about that. The advice that I always give to people, you know, designers, engineers who are trying to build a portfolio, is a big mistake that I see is that people always try to tell the story of the project. And it's like, don't tell the story of the project. That's the agency's job. If, you know, if you're working for an agency, your agency is going to put that story, you know, that case study up. Tell your story on the project, not what did we do? What did I do? I did this thing. I learned this thing. I messed up over here. I made these sketches. I read this book. Like, what is your story of the project? And you can always tell your story without violating an NDA. right? There are going to be some details in your story that have some proprietary information. Don't share that stuff. But specifically with design system stuff, talk about the stakeholders that you talked to. What conversations did you have? What did your notes look like? You can, you know, you can redact all of the proprietary or whatever in there, but that story is still interesting. If you can't do that for whatever reason, if too much of that is redacted, which most times is not the case, but let's just say extreme scenario, most of it is redacted, make up something that you can work on. Like build a design system. What's your favorite brand? You love Uniqlo? Great, make a design system for Uniqlo. Show me how you would do it. And do it in your unique way. Are you better on video than writing a case study? Well, then show, like, make a YouTube video about how you would do it. Are you great with motion graphics? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Use Loom. I've seen lots of great portfolios in Loom, which is awesome because that's what I want to hear. As a hiring manager, I want to know how people think through this stuff. So
if you watch my show for any extent of the time, I keep saying that it's how it's getting this out on paper or through voice.
I had my head of business development used to say, like, you just got to be smart in public. Just got
to
be
smart. Yeah, I'm not smart. Smart in public, not smart in my house. My wife can attest to that.
So. Same with me. Ask my family.
Yeah, exactly. As we wrap up here, Mike, some information there, folks. If you are looking at some insurance, look at that comment. Jose comes in with the age old question, specialist in the area or know everything for a freelance project.
I mean, the easy answer to that is like, is it better to know everything or not know everything? Well, it's better to know everything. So know right. as close to everything as you can with taking care of yourself, right? You can spend all of your days reading books and watching YouTube videos and doing the tutorials and doing all that stuff. And then your friends hate you and your family hates you and you don't talk to anybody and you stay in your house. And like, who's that good for? That's not good for you or for anybody else. So I would say it's good to be a generalist and it's good to be a specialist on as many things as you can handle as, you know, I mean, in your life.
You can, you know, because I work, you know, in a talent marketplace side of things. And I mean, if you know, I'm pulling out the word Elm. I don't even know what Elm is. I know it's like a code or framework or something. If you know Elm, you can find lots of jobs using Elm, right? And so like, even if you're super niche, especially, Dan, I don't know if you've seen this. I would say especially right now, man, honestly, I think more niche is even better sometimes. I don't know. I mean, it's an age old question, but I think niche is, right now, because there's so many generalists, I feel like I think going back to the niche side of things could really carve out a substantial amount of work for you.
So I can be more specific than my last answer of like everything is everything. I think that being a specialist draws people to you initially. And then once you are in their employ or they're hired by them or whatever, then they want you to be a generalist.
Right.
So that's the catch 22 is like if you're like developer. Then and somebody is looking for an Elm developer or an Elm specialist, you're not going to be the person that they consider because you're too much of a generalist at that moment for them in that part of the process. They want someone who has done Elm for 10 years. You know, they want someone who's done React for 5 years, for 6 years. They want someone who has used React Router for that amount of time. So the way that you draw people to you is much better if you have a niche, if you have a specific positioning. But once you get in there, you're going to need to be a generalist about things. So yeah. That's the thing that's tough about it, is if you're only a specialist, you actually can't serve the back half of that relationship. If you're only a generalist, you can't serve the front half of that relationship. So that's how I think that both of those two things work together.
Dan, I want to be respectful of you. Can you go 5 more minutes?
I can. Let's do it.
All right, sweet. All right, let's get to another question down here. Colton, it's good to see you, buddy. Colton's a frequent viewer of the show. Do you think that there's a risk in freelancing with a type non-tech business that isn't a necessity for business? I'm a photographer on the side. Colton, my wife is a commercial photographer freelance, but I have blockers for making money long-term in the business versus, yeah.
100%. I think that there is a massive risk to being in a business that is seen as a cost center or seen as a bonus, you know, even worse to whoever your client is. If a client is like, oh, that's a thing that I do when I have a lot of money, it's going to be the first thing that goes in a recession or in an economic downturn or something like that. So I think that's a really tough place to be. I'm not suggesting that you find a different line of business, although if you can do that, that's great. But is there a way that you can frame your business as crucial? You know, is there a way that you can? So as an example, I specialize in design systems. And one of the things in design systems is design systems in big enterprises, they get funded by a different bucket than other work does, right? They get funded generally by the operational expense bucket. And a lot of my work is actually convincing a lot of organizations to fund it from the capital expense budget because it's written off differently. It's funded differently. It's talked about differently. Yeah. And so a lot of your work, you know, in whatever business you're in, it behooves you to actually convince your clients ahead of time that they should be thinking about your work differently. They should be thinking about it as crucial to their business, not like a nice to have that like, oh yeah, you know, photography, for example, you know, photographer on the side that has blockers for making money long term. If you're a photographer that offers services that are like, I do luxury resort photography. Well, if a client sees that as extra, you're going to be the first thing to be cut in an economic downturn. So how can you make that a crucial part of their business? Can you incorporate that into their business strategy? Could you make your work or frame your work as a strategic endeavor as opposed to a bonus endeavor? The more successful you are with that kind of stuff, the more your clients, I think, will see you differently.
I love that. Real quick, I'm gonna get to one more question. Dan, I think we're gonna have to have a part two. LinkedIn user comes in here. How easy is it to market oneself, and what are the channels one can follow? I'm gonna chime in real fast. Marketing is difficult. Most of y'all suck at it. It's fine though. It's fine. If your skills are not marketing, look up recruiting agencies and talent marketplaces. So if you want to get into the contract world, but you know that you just don't like marketing, I have placed developers, designers 5, 6, 7 times throughout their career on a contract basis while I was at my last company as a recruiter. Now I'm on the talent marketplace side. We can place the same person so many dang times because it's all a lot of part-time stuff, and we can move you around and give you a bunch of work. But if you want to go out on your own, it's content. Putting things out on the internet. I talk a lot about this on my show. Social proofing your career is a necessity. Dan, I don't know if you have more thoughts on this.
100%. I'll just add a quick thing to that, which is that I started as a developer and then I became a designer. The way that I did that was I took down my development portfolio for a year and I just took design projects and then remarketed myself as a designer a year later. So it's possible. You know, that was in 2004, you know, so like times have changed. But it's possible. To the second half of that question, how easy to market oneself? What are the channels one can follow? I agree with what Taylor's saying. Any channel. Don't worry too much about where people are. It's where can you be consistent? If you can post YouTube videos once a week, once a month, once a day, whatever that is, do that thing. If you can't do that, don't be on YouTube. If you can post Instagram content once a day, once a week, once a month, be on Instagram. If you can do it on LinkedIn or Twitter or whatever, I think the common wisdom is you can make $1 million on any one channel. If you want to make more than $1 million, then a multi-channel strategy is probably better for you. But if you're like, $1 million sounds great, I'll make $1 million. One channel will get you that if you can do that consistently, probably for 2 or 3 years. So it's not a short game kind of thing. You know, it's a long game kind of thing, but it's also not like 30 years. It's like, in 3 years, it's 5 years, you can do it.
Of consistently posting on LinkedIn and Twitter before getting business. And the year, I've talked to a lot of other content creators, aka marketers, around content, and it's about a year of every day of something. So, all right, Dan, rapid fire, 4 questions. I didn't tell you about them because I want them on the spot. First question: what outside of work brings you joy?
Playing basketball.
I follow you on Instagram. You play a lot of basketball, dude.
I played last night. I'm hurting
a lot. That's awesome. Do you have like a position you typically play? Like, is it?
I'm a true point guard. A true point guard.
Here we go. I like it. Second question. If money was not the issue, what would you do outside of tech?
Oh, outside of tech. I would teach parents how to be intentional about raising their kids.
Damn, man, maybe I need to hang out with you a little bit. Learn from you. I love that. I love that so much. Third question: tools, technologies, frameworks, books, trends that you've read, you've watched, you're tinkering with that you're pretty stoked about right now.
I love all the no-code stuff right now, the Webflows, the framers, all that kind of stuff. I think it's going to be the future. AI is super exciting to me. It's early days, but I think that stuff is super cool. I'm really into like productivity stuff right now because I feel very unproductive. So I'm reading all the productivity books and things like that.
Anything usually you've picked up lately that is a little bit of a secret sauce you want to share?
Buy Back Your Time is a book by Dan Martell. Okay. It's convinced me to hire a full-time assistant, and that is a power-up. Like, and it's one of those things that I'm like, I can't afford a full-time assistant. That's for like bigwigs and CEO. Like, That book proved me entirely wrong. It said, like, this is how much money you should spend. This is how you can do it. This is how you make it all back. It's been a game changer.
Yeah, I want to shout out to Jason. Jason is my part-time project coordinator. So, Jason, you the man. Appreciate you, buddy. Last question, Dan, and we'll get you on your way again. Thank you all for hanging out with us today. We'll try to set up a part two here soon because this was a lot of fun. But Dan, the show's called Guidance Counselor 2.0 because we had guidance counselors in middle school, high school, and college. But now as adults, we don't really have a guidance counselor to turn to per se. What would be your biggest piece of career advice to young Dan?
Keep going, dude. Like, don't. You're doing it. It'll take a while to show up, but keep going. This is the advice that I'm telling myself right now. This is the advice that my mentors are telling me right now, too, as a 40-year-old, that I think is the same thing for a 22-year-old.
That's awesome. I love that. All right, y'all. Well, thank you again for hanging out with us. Dan, stay on the real quick. So it's about you backstage. Y'all have a great one. Go connect with Dan. Dan, where can people find you on Twitter?
Twitter, I'm Dan Mall. DanMall.com is my website. Dan Mall on LinkedIn. So basically, any of your social platforms, search Dan Mall or Dan Mall Teaches, and you'll find me there. Please connect with me.
I love it. All right, y'all. You guys have a great one tomorrow. We have Joe Prevett back on the show. He got laid off 3 times last year, and he found all of his jobs through content creation. So we're going to talk about it tomorrow. Imagine that. Y'all have a good one. See y'all tomorrow morning.
Thanks, everybody. Peace. Thanks, Taylor.
Hey, you did it. You listened to an entire episode, and I am very grateful because you know why? There's a lot of podcasts out there. There's a lot of episodes, and I myself rarely finish an entire episode. So I appreciate you so, so much for listening. Quick reminder, please rate and review this podcast in the App Store. I want this to be discoverable to others. And the only way that happens is if you take the time right now and rate and review it, please, like right now, unless you're driving, then don't do it. So thank you again. If you need to reach out to me at T Destin on all social media handles, and I hope you have a fantastic day.